Thanks for joining us for this Views and Brews podcast, recorded live at the Cactus Cafe in Austin, Texas. We hope you enjoy the show.
I'm Rebecca McEnroe with KUT. The Dutch scientist and the writer Louis Fresco said, "Food in the end, in our own tradition, is something holy. It's not about nutrients and calories. It's about sharing. It's about honesty. It's about identity." And it's through food that our guest tonight remembers her good friend, a woman who took no prisoners, a woman whose quick wit and shrewd analysis has left a lasting stain upon the silence, the great Molly Ivins. Woo! Here with me to remember Molly, the award-winning reporter and author of Stirring It Up with Molly Ivins, a memoir with recipes, Ellen Sweets. Welcome. Thank you.
Thank you. Thank all of you for being out here. You are really crazy. In this heat, I wouldn't be here if I weren't planning to spend the night because the air conditioning is better here than it is at my house.
Oh, you can join me. I usually spend the night at the Cactus. Well, as you can see, we have a couple more chairs on the stage. And unfortunately, Lou DuBois couldn't make it tonight, or else we would have him as well. But we do have a couple special guests who are going to join us a little later on in the conversation. So that's very exciting. And we also have, before we start our lovely conversation, a gift from the Texas Observer. So if you can answer this question, you will be the winner of this lovely bag with a picture of dear Molly Ivins on the back. Goodies. So who was the television personality who attended college with Molly's mother? Nope. I think we got him on this one. That's a good question. No.
Where did she go to college?
Smith. It was Julia Child. That's kind of a disingenuous question. Okay, when was Molly's birthday? It looks like we have a lot to learn tonight, folks. Well, we will give it away to one lucky winner, but we'll figure that out a little later. First of all, Ellen, let's talk about this amazing book. It's so beautiful. It's such a touching memory. And it is really gorgeous. Can you tell us a little bit about how you met Molly the first time?
It was so weird. And it's even stranger that our friendship evolved and revolved around food, around cooking together. I had been tracking Molly's writing when I lived out east, and she was writing for the New York Times. And I had heard about her before, and I just wanted to meet this woman from Texas. And it just never happened. So the next thing I knew, I had moved to Dallas. I left my corporate job in the dark side and went back to doing what I knew how to do, and I was hired by the Dallas Morning News. My ACLU membership followed me to Dallas. And after, well, I know. And the thing was that when I worked for Bell Labs, when I worked for AT&T, it didn't matter what you belonged to. In the newsroom, you can't belong to anything that even remotely suggests partiality. So I figured, well, since I'm moving and my subscription, my membership is going to expire, I'll just hold on to it. And I forwarded it. And lo and behold, because I did not love Dallas, I loved my job. I loved working for the Morning News. Did not love Dallas. I got an invitation to something called the Jefferson Day Dinner. And lo and behold, Molly Ivins was going to be the moderator. I immediately signed up. And although people who know me think that I'm just the most gregarious person in the world, but that happens when I'm with people I know. On my own, I really have a lot of trouble insinuating myself into a social situation. So I don't know how many of you have seen The Princess Bride, but I decided I'm going to go by myself, and I practiced over and over and over. I kept saying, "Hello, my name is Ellen Sweets. I'm here. I don't know a soul." And I would extend my hand. This was in lieu of, "Hello, my name is Inigo Montoya. You kill my father. Prepare to die." I wasn't going to threaten anybody's life, but I wanted, and I kept saying it over and over, and I parked on the parking lot, and I'm walking along, honest to God, I'm walking along, and I'm saying, hello, my name is Ellen Sweets, I just moved here, and I don't know a soul, hello. So I rounded the corner of the entrance to the building, and there was this woman sitting on a stone bench, and she was sort of finishing off a Marlboro Light, and I walked up to her, and I said what I said I was going to say. Hello, my name is Ellen Sweets. I just moved here, and I don't know a soul. And she extended her hand. She said, well, hello there, Ellen Sweets. My name is Molly Ivins. And just like that, it's like, holy cow, I'm meeting the woman I came to see. And she said, you just moved here? I said, yes. Yeah. She said, what you doing here? And I said, well, I'm a reporter for the Dallas Morning News. She said, well, I'll be goddamn. She said, come on in, girl. And she said, I can't ask you to join us at my table, but we'll find, you know, just find a place to sit, and then afterwards we'll go out for a drink. And we did. And in the course of conversation, she and I somehow or other started talking about food. And it sort of evolved from the fact that the food that we'd had was really not bad. And, you know, for chicken dinner. And so we started talking about food, and one thing led to another. And as the drinks kept coming, she said, well, what you need to do is come down to Austin and stay with me, and we'll cook together. Well, you know how those things go when you've been drinking, and you say, yeah,
hey, whenever you're in town, make sure you call me.
And I said, okay. But what she doesn't know, what she didn't know at the time, which she subsequently found out, is that you say that to me, I'll turn up. And I'll turn up hungry. So, the first time I went down to Austin to see her, we were at a Final Friday, which at the time was being held at La Zona Rosa. And Gordon Fowler still owned it. And I met one person after another. I met Malcolm Greenstein, I met Del Garcia, met Elliot Neistat. And I, over time, realized that this was sort of her tribe. Molly knew a lot of people, but she was only close to a handful. And I was privileged to become a part of that handful. And I think it was because I'm a good cook.
Well, you know, so we mentioned that her mom went to school with Julia Child, but she also had a love affair with France. Can you tell us a little bit about, you know, her background and her love affair with France and with French cooking and with French cuisine, and how you kind of got to know that and what those conversations were a little bit like?
It was amazing because from her high school years, and I don't think Carl is here tonight, but he went to high school with her, and in her junior year, Molly went to France, and her junior year abroad, and it made an incredible impression on her, and she became a real Francophile. She became fluent in French. She wanted to cook in French. She could whip up a mean pot of chili, but she could also do a saumon papillote, and she would do, you know, salmon wrapped in parchment, and she would do these incredible layered potato casseroles. She was really, really a fabulous cook. But she was not a food snob. And I often wonder what she would say today about kale. You know? I have, Jesus Christ. Black people have been eating kale since forever, and we're all going, really? Okay. I just got back from the Bay Area, and the one thing that blew me away, among other things that I thought were really strange in San Francisco, was a thing for a kale smoothie. And if any of you out there, I'm sorry if I've offended any kale smoothie fans out there, but come on.
I just had one before I came, so sorry. But just kidding. You know, that's one thing. Reading the chapters about you two shopping together is really funny.
Oh, Jesus. Okay, now, you know, here I am. You can see. I'm a little shorter than I was 10 years ago. It happens, right? So there's Molly at 6 feet, blonde, strawberry blonde, whatever you call that color she did to her hair, and 6 feet tall. And there's me, short, black, afro. It was like Mutton Chef in the grocery store. And we would make these plans. I would let me just tell you, I would come down to Austin from Dallas, because I always wanted to live here. And I would come down here from Dallas, and we would head out straight away to the grocery store. We would make a grocery list, and it was very definitive, it was very detailed. We'd tear it in half. I'd take one half, she'd take one half. And we'd set off to the grocery store. We'd get to the grocery store, and she said, okay, what are we getting? And I said, well, I don't know. Don't you have the grocery list? And she'd say, no, I thought you had it. I thought, oh, shit. You know, this is going to be interesting. So we would sort of try and remember more or less what we had planned to buy. And of course, because my revenue stream was substantially less than Molly's, I was very careful about adhering to as close as possible what we were supposed to have, especially for the dish that we were cooking. Molly loved gumbo. She loved to make gumbo. And of course, her concept of making gumbo was to mix the drinks, chop the onions, celery, and bell pepper, and garlic, and then sit down and watch me stir the pot. So I know generally what we're supposed to get. And so we set out on this expedition to shop. And I would get exactly what I knew would go in the gumbo. And Molly would walk up and down the aisles and she'd say, oh, I haven't seen this before. Don't you think this would be fun? I'd say, no. No, it has nothing to do with what we're making. Yes, but we might cook something else. Molly, it's Friday. I'm here Saturday. I'm leaving Sunday. What else would we cook? Well, you could go home Monday and we could cook this on Sunday. I cannot tell you how many times, and my editors at the Morning News were such good sports because I consistently found a different story for why I only turned up at 11 o'clock on Monday or noon on Monday or not at all on Monday. Wild.
It's Molly's fault.
Yeah. Molly's fault.
So, you know, I mean, through food, it's really the entryway into so many conversations. Can you tell us about a few conversations that you had that ended up being really deep, but started with perhaps conversations about kale or something?
Molly was one of the few white people, white women, certainly, that I was ever able to have a stomp-down, straight-ahead, honest conversation about race and class and color and how incredibly screwed up this country is when it comes to addressing issues of race, class, and color. And sometimes we'd put the knives down and pour a glass and sit down and really talk about it. But then I must tell you, in all honesty, after a few pours, we kind of forgot what we were talking about. Because, honest to goodness, I think, you know, I used to say to Molly, don't take offense, anybody. And I'd say, oh, God, spare me, white liberals. No, no, no. But Molly was not a white liberal. She was, through and through, a decent human being who cared deeply about the social issues that fracture this country. And I don't know if that conversation is ever going to take place. I so much wish she could be here now, like most of you who were crazy enough to come out in this heat. I think that she would be so sad that the fracture has run so deep and that we as a voting populace have allowed it to happen. Yeah. We can't, you know, there's some things we can't blame other people for. And I have told people time and time again, if you're one of those people who says, I don't vote because my one vote doesn't count, don't talk to me anymore, because I don't have anything else to say to you. Because if everybody who said, my one vote doesn't count, voted, we wouldn't be looking at the three morons heading our state right now. But that's just me. Molly would have had a more deft way of putting it. I was yin to her yang, or she was yang to my yin, whatever, you know. She wrote with a scalpel. She, you know, I'm a hacksaw kind of person. I'm a meat axe, but she wrote with a stiletto, and she was able to capture the essence of an issue with humor. No one else is doing that today. Hers was a unique voice.
I think what she said in her book, Who Let the Dogs In, was that if you think it doesn't matter, then congratulations, you're informed, but you're not smart. Yeah. Because if you were smart, you would vote.
Yes.
Yeah, and get involved. You know, I would, speaking of her approach to issues of class and race and the civil rights movement, I was wondering, did she ever speak about the powerlessness that she felt as an East Texan during the civil rights movement? I remember what she said was, in one interview, she said, in East Texas, if you were into civil rights, you were scared and hot most of the time, and that was pretty much it. But there wasn't really, she didn't really feel like she was making an impact. What did that leave in her psyche that kept her fighting? Because she just fought to the end.
She was a true believer. She believed that wherever, I think there's some sort of biblical scripture that says wherever people are gathered in my name. She believed that wherever there were Democrats, if there were 5, if there were 10, if there were 15, she would go and talk to them. And I have to just, and she would. I mean, I have, and what was even more wonderful is that for, I don't think it's classified information anymore, but I, she would, if she believed in an organization that needed to hear her message, she would waive her speaking fees. She would just charge for transportation, air flight transportation, and meals. My favorite story about her going to East Texas to speak to a group of people, I think there were maybe 15 or 20, it was the Democratic Club of Jefferson, Texas. Now remember, this is not Jefferson 2015, before the gays came and made it cool. This was way back, way before Jefferson was cool. And so she was on her way, and as usual, she was running late, and she was very, very hungry, and she knew she wasn't going to eat once she got there. So she stopped to have breakfast, and she kind of scarfed it up, and the waitress came by after, as she finished eating, scooped it up. She said, well, honey, you must have really been hungry. You ate all that green stuff, too. And Hannah and Molly said, well, yeah, that's parsley. Parsley's really good for you. It has iron. And she said, well, honey, if I'd known she was going to eat it, I'd have washed it.
So while we're on stories, I have so many questions. I could talk to you about this book forever and ever and ever, but I want to know, what is your favorite story from the book? What do you wake up and you still laugh about?
You mean like now? As I think I said before, one of Molly's favorite dishes was gumbo. And almost every time I came down, she asked me to help her make it. I knew what that meant. Make it. So I ragged on her forever about this very expensive set of, I forget what make, knives.
Wusthof.
My daughter cooked with her. The whole set of Wusthof knives, including the sharpener. Of course, Molly had no idea how to sharpen a knife. But I said, you know, I'm not coming down here anymore and using these knives. I'm going to bring my own if you don't get them sharpened, because knives that aren't sharpened are dangerous. So, okay, I come down. Molly says, and I'll have you know, I had the goddamn knives sharpened. Okay, thank you so much. So she's over here. Did I say that we sometimes cooked and had no idea who was going to eat what we cooked? So we decided if it was gumbo, it's going to be a big crowd. So we're making this big pot of gumbo. And I thought, okay, I'm going to fix her. She's going to cut the onions. I'll chop up the celery and the bell peppers and the garlic. And we're talking, and I really should confess up front, there was drinking involved. So she's drinking, I'm drinking, and I'm chopping up stuff, and she's chopping up stuff, and I'm happy because these knives are so sharp. And I look over, and there's a little red line running under the mound of onions. And I'm thinking, did we buy red onions? And I look at Molly's finger, and it's bleeding. I said, Ma, did you cut yourself? And she said, well, I'll be goddamn. Look at that. And she's got blood running down her hand, down her wrist, onto the onions. I said, Molly, blood in the food. And she had this huge colander, and she got it out. She scooped all the onions in it. She ran some cold water over it. She said, there, no blood. Said, anyway, it's going into a roux. The heat'll kill whatever's there. Not a problem. Not a problem. I think this is going to be a very interesting pot of food. So we keep going. We keep going. I slowed down on the drinking because I can't keep up with her. She's 6 feet tall. I'm 5 feet one. So we finish with the cooking, and she wouldn't even put the onions or anything in a blender. She said it, you know, in a food processor. She said it affects the oils. Okay, fine. So we get it all together, and we put the sausage in, and we take the sausage out after it's cooked, and we cut it up, and we put the crab meat in so that it flavors it. And at the last minute, we put the shrimp in, and then we take it off the stove. We leave the oysters until the next day, because you always make gumbo the day before you want to eat it. So we talk a little bit more, we clean up the kitchen, and we put the food in containers to go in the refrigerator. And I look at the refrigerator, and it was just after Molly had one of those episodes where she'd been in the hospital for treatment for her breast cancer. And the refrigerator was filled with food. And I said, Molly, that's not going to fit. She said, of course it will. And, you know, when somebody who's 6 feet tall, and you're only 5 foot one, you don't argue beyond a certain point. You just sort of say, I don't think so. And she shoves it in. And I said, well, Molly, we just have to remember that the first person to open the refrigerator in the morning needs to remember that that might fall out. So off we go. And the next morning, she always woke up before I did. And I thought, oh my God, she's awake. I got to get in the kitchen quick. And I go into the kitchen just as she is opening the refrigerator door. And of course, you all know what happened. Whether you've read the book or not, you know what happened. And this one container comes flying out. And of course, it's the glass one. And you see everything happening in slow motion, and you say, I can do this. And we're both at the same time going, no. And boom, It lands on her tile floor, and it cleaves into three big pieces. And I'm thinking, oh my God. And I look at Molly, and Molly looks at me, and she gives me that look. You know, after we'd been friends for a while, I learned to identify the look, and the looks was like my mother's when you got, don't you open your mouth. Don't you say a word. Not gonna happen. So I said, and with that she said, don't just stand there, get a container. And so I did. We started scooping stuff up the floor.
Oh my God.
This is $200 worth of seafood. I mean, come on. So we're picking it up, and I mean, we looked for shards of glass, and we, you know. And it was one of those oversized blenders, because she liked to make juices and smoothies and stuff. And when we finished, we put it together, and we saw that there were no pieces of glass missing. And we started all over again with the roux and the onions and the bell peppers, but we saved the shrimp, the sausage, and the crab meat. But I failed to notice that it had fallen on her toe and broken it. So that the next day, when people started streaming in and we were, you know, cooking the rice and everybody was excited about gumbo, and we ate and ate. I mean, those people cleaned up. And at the end of it, several people said, oh my God, that is the best gumbo you guys have ever made. What did you do different? I said, oh.
You had Rick Perry over for dinner that night.
Yeah.
Well, we have a couple very special guests with us tonight as well, who I have a few questions for before we open things up for comments. One is the Pulitzer Prize winning editorial cartoonist, Ben Sargent. Would you mind joining us? And the other special guest is the researcher, scheduler, personal assistant, and known by Molly as her chief of staff, Betsy Moon. Welcome. Thank you so much. So, Betsy, I'd like to start with you, chief of staff. What kind of stuff? What was Molly's day like? What was a typical day for Molly like?
If it was a column day, Molly would call me around 9 or 10 in the morning and tell me what she wanted to write about. I would start to gather materials. And then for the next hour or so, she would ask me specific questions. She always knew exactly what she wanted to say in the column. So her questions were specific. I saw George Bush yesterday standing on a mound of garbage. Was it Michigan or Minnesota? You know, that kind of very, because she already had the whole thing in her head from whatever had made her mad that day. Our columns, those would just pour out of her, and by noon we would send them off to first the Star Telegram when I was working for her, and then soon after that she left them and started working just for the syndicate. So, let's see, she was... So that would be a typical day. She often wrote magazine articles that were longer, 50,000 words. She did 3 books while I worked with her. did seem like that sometimes. And she traveled all the time. Ellen mentioned how she would go places for whatever the group could pay, or she had promised John Henry Falk when he was dying that she would take care of the First Amendment for him. And the specific, actually Ben did a there's a beautiful cartoon I have that you drew of her with the First Amendment. the form that took was that she gave one free speech a month to a group that worked on First Amendment issues. It was often an ACLU affiliate.
And what was her writing style like? She got up pretty early. Was she writing as soon as she was up?
No, she didn't get up that early.
Oh, just earlier than Ellen. I'm sorry. I correct myself.
Oh, I didn't know.
Noon.
No, it really was 9 or 10 by the time, 10 o'clock by the time I would hear from her. She would have had coffee and read her papers and, you know, be ready. But the part that I worked for Jim Hightower before Molly, and I also worked with him on several books, and their style was really different. I mean, not the final product, which was always very progressive and liberal from viewpoint, and hilarious and excellent writing. Neither of them really needed an editor when they turned something in. But Jim wanted to know everything about the topic, so I would gather up, you know, stacks and stacks of things for him to look at. And Molly was much more specific, like I said, the Michigan or Minnesota, you know. So.
That's beautiful. Ben, talk a little bit about your relationship with Molly when you first met her and what that was like.
Well, I started out in this business as a printer, and so I was working at Futura Press in South Austin, where there's a very shishi restaurant in there now, but in those days, South Congress was a little more down home, and Futura Press, as you probably remember, belonged to Bill and Ann McAfee, and they printed every piece of political material and bumper stickers and everything for every Democrat in this county and surrounding counties. They also printed the Texas Observer. And so I was, my cousin Stuart Long had gotten me a job over there with Bill. And I would be there when Molly and Kay Northcott would come over and look at their proofs and stuff for the Observer. And I distinctly recall the first time I saw them come in, because you talk about Mutt and Jeff suites. I mean, here was this, Molly came in and had on, like, she looked like something out of Laura Ingalls Wilder. I mean, she had this this sort of like leather prairie dress on down to her ankles, and this little sort of 19th century blouse with a high collar, and but she was as tall as I was, and so it was a very striking effect. And then here was Kay kind of tagging along behind her. So but we sort of immediately hit it off and enjoyed getting to know each other. And it was, I think sometime after that I began approaching the Observer, and I think I first approached Kay about doing some drawings for them. And at that time, that was before I was doing newspaper cartooning at all, and I still had like drawings I'd done in high school and stuff, and I think Kay was not impressed, and I didn't get any work from them for quite a while.
That was a big current.
Yes.
Could you talk a little bit about kind of the big picture of the position of satire in political reporting? You know, your cartoons are fabulous and also, you know, biting wit, really.
No, you're too kind, but yeah, I think it satire is and always has been, as long as there's been any, you know, people to comment on their societies and the politics of their societies, it's been a necessary way of just dealing with it, because it's the way of just cutting through all the bullshit that tends to accumulate around government, politics, and society. And certainly that's what I was, you know, at least nominally occupied with for 35 years as a political cartoonist, and tried to exercise some of that. But certainly I would absolutely be in the shadow of Molly. I mean, she was such a master of using satire and using that kind of expression to cut through everything and really get to the heart of things and to the truth. And you know, she certainly was an incomparable writer and was incomparably funny, but the main thing about her and the real heart of satire was her perception and her way of seeing things, her ability to see things and to root the truth out of all the storm of, you know, of stuff that's around you. It's that was her true gift. I mean, and it was on a level with you know, H.L. Mencken or Mark Twain. I mean, she was truly one of a kind.
Yeah, but Ben, there's a reason you won a Pulitzer, okay? And don't be too damn modest.
I can tell you that
what
story,
I
too.
What I would like for you to talk a little bit about is that wonderful cartoon that you did at the end. And I want you to describe it. I want you to talk to us a little bit about how you came about doing that. And that was the one where we're all looking at Molly's gravestone.
Right.
And it says R.I.P.
Yeah.
Have you all seen that? If you haven't found it, talk
yeah,
to
me. Yeah, I think, when Molly died, it was, you know, it was something, and we all kind of knew it was coming. And so I pondered, I knew I wanted to do something, you know, at that point. And just thought and thought, how am I going to do this? How do you, you know, encapsulate the death of somebody who you love so much and who is so truly great? But then I remembered the title of her book, of one of her many books, and yeah, the cartoon shows a family looking at Molly's tombstone, and I think it has her name and her dates, and then it says farewell. And the child is there saying, Molly Ivins can't say that, can she?